Welcome to the Beyond Atheism podcast with me, Nathan Alexander, and my co-host, Todd Tavares. Moving beyond questions of God's existence, this podcast asks, what's next in a godless world? If you're enjoying the show so far, please like and subscribe, rate and review, and consider supporting us on Patreon.
Here on Beyond Atheism, we prefer to focus on the work and success of secularism. So we often overlook the obstacles to toleration and acceptance of atheism that hide in plain sight. Joining us today to talk about some of the ways society and institutions create and maintain a pro-Christian and anti-atheist bias is Dr. Christina Lee. She's an assistant professor in communication studies at the University of South Dakota. Her research focuses on the ways language is used to diminish and exclude atheists, how Christian nationalists communicate, and interfaith dialogue. Professor Lee, welcome to Beyond Atheism.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Christina, for coming on. Just to get started, can you tell us a bit about how you got into this work? Tell us a little bit about your background and if you were raised religious and so on.
So I was raised religious. I was raised Presbyterian. And when I was probably about 15, I started questioning religion. And over the next 5 to 6 years, I slowly became an atheist. It took me a while to willingly say that. But once I became an open atheist, I started noticing how differently I was treated oftentimes. I had quite a few friends who would be upset that I would just say I was an atheist. And I started noticing as well that people would oftentimes just assume that I believed in God and would be very shocked when I said I was an atheist, which I thought was a really weird phenomena. And so when I went to grad school, I had no intention of studying religion politics, but I wrote a paper and just kind of fell into this interest of thinking about the experiences of atheists, particularly in the United States.
Mm-hmm. So that was a lived experience first. Was it that dramatic? Was that immediate? Was there any middle ground?
Yeah, so it was very hit and miss. I was very fortunate in that my family is all still religious, but my immediate family was very supportive, which is a big help for me. But it was definitely things like I would have friends who would send me messages on social media. When I first moved to Colorado for my graduate program, there was a man in front of me in the line to go register to vote who went on a very long, aggressive rant about how atheists are destroying this country, which was very uncomfortable. Or I would have students who would make comments that made me think that they assumed that I was religious, which was very awkward because I didn't know if I was safe to say that I wasn't. So it made me realize that it was just, there was a sense of having to guard my identity as an atheist that I had never felt when I was Christian. And that was really striking to me.
And so is that that's the seed of your research agenda then?
Yes, definitely. It's really about understanding. And I'm not interested in promoting atheism or converting anyone to atheism, but how do we explain this experience and talk about this marginalization, which I didn't see at the time when I started a lot of research on.
This might be a good place to start then. Building from what you experienced yourself, what did you start to find in research as part of this, like the bias against atheism?
Yeah. So one of the things that I noticed when I would read, especially in my field, people talking about atheism is they oftentimes would just equate atheism to the new atheist movement, which simplifies a very complex group of people into kind of the angry anti-theists. And I would see a lot of times people using data to say, oh, polls show that only 1% of people in the 1950s were atheists. And I was kind of I'd see those things and say, well, we don't actually know that. It's just that they were who were willing to say they were an atheist in the 1950s. So I was just noticing a lot of assumptions that were just painting incomplete pictures. And so that was kind of where I started. And so a lot of my research initially actually started by doing a project of looking at how presidents talked about atheists in their major speeches. And it was not very nice, usually. But I was also really struck not just by the fact that on the rare occasions they did talk about atheists, it was generally quite negative, but that generally when they talked about the American people, they talked about them as a group of people who believed in God, and so was very exclusionary of atheists. And I thought that that kind of pointed to this issue I was getting of people kind of just assuming that I was theistic because there was an assumption that as a community, we are mm-hmm. believers in a higher power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it seems like maybe we can bring this term in now that I guess you coined it, theist normativity. It's pretty cool that you've already got your own concept. Can you tell us what is that?
Yeah. So, this kind of came again from that research I was doing. And really, I was looking at a speech given by Eisenhower in which he consistently, his inaugural address, in which he consistently talked about the American people and just assumed that they believed in God. Like he would say things like, please join me in prayer. So kind of assuming everyone would join him in prayer, talking about people as if this assumption that they believe in God. And so I kind of just in this paper kind of throughout the term theist normativity, because I didn't know how else to explain it. So I kind of just said, you know, he's using this theist normative appeals. And one of my advisors was like, where'd you get this term? And I was like, I just made it up. She's like, that, yes. Just do that.
Right.
And so in the research that I do, that I have found there's other terms that are semi-similar. There's a term by Chris Thedman that talks about theonormativity, which is more broadly the normalization of religion. There's also a term in media studies called Christonormativity, which is the normalization of Christianity. Theist normativity kind of falls in between in that it's specifically this tendency in the United States in particular to use a vague God reference that kind of seems inclusive of most theists, but is also oftentimes tied to Christonormativity, but it's very anti-atheist at its core.
Mm. So tell us more about it. This is a start, right? So it starts with this assumption that everyone believes in God at the very least, right?
Yes.
What does it move to and how does it sort of create this impression that this is what we are and what we ought to be?
One of the things that theist normativity does is it draws this connection between belief in God and kind of senses of good citizenship and being truly American in the case of the United States. So there was a study done by the Public Religious Research Institute that found that 69% of respondents said that they agreed with the statement that to be truly American, people need to believe in God, which is a very large percentage, and I found that really concerning. Additionally, 52% said that you need to be Christian to be truly American, which is also concerning. But yeah, I was really struck by particularly this idea that belief in God was so closely tied. And particularly interesting is that this is something you see across political spectrum of both Republicans and Democrats tended to agree with that statement. And so I think that's really closely tied to these different kind of theist normative narratives we see in the United States, like in God we trust, under God, you know, God bless America. And so a lot of my research is tied to how those became part of kind of our narrative in general.
Well, it seems to be relate at least in the contemporary to a lot of Christian nationalism. This is also something you study as well. So first of all, is this part of an ongoing project that's been like the idea of Christian nationalism? Is there this continuation from the 1950s, from the 60s when there are these programs first start occurring, like the national motto and the Pledge of Allegiance, or is this a modern phenomenon?
Yeah. So one of the things that I argue in my work is that theist normativity and Christian normativity and really Christian nationalism are ingrained in U.S. culture, and they have been from the foundation. And I think we have a tendency to talk about Christian nationalism as this new phenomena that arose from the rise of the moral majority. But I would argue that while that is when we start to see this really partisan Christian nationalism, you see traces of it as early as the founding. So there were a lot of people in the 1800s who were very upset that the founders did not did not include the Christian God in the Constitution. And you see a movement, and really it was pushed by a group called the National Reform Association to try to get what was called the Christian Amendment into the Constitution, which was an amendment that would say, we recognize Jesus Christ as our Lord and Savior and the bestower of our gifts. So you see this emerge really immediately. You see this type of narrative in the late 1700s, early 1800s, and particularly through the Civil War. And then this group obviously failed continuously to get the Christian Amendment passed. But a lot of the same people were the people behind getting In God We Trust on coins during the Civil War. And you see a lot of, if you look at Under God in the Pledge in the 1950s and God We Trust, those types of things, there was also very much Christian nationalists behind that as well. And so you just see throughout U.S. history, these kind of reemergences of Christian nationalism, and scholars have called them different things throughout time. But I think at its core, it's very much this idea that for democracy to succeed, we need to be a Christian nation. Christians make for the best citizens. Christians make for the best leaders. And so we should be basing our laws off of Christian policies. And they oftentimes will use theist normative narratives to push this narrative that's saying, you know, we're not excluding other religions because God's not specific. But then they also are using it to specifically talk about the Christian God as well. So it's very beneficial for them in that sense.
So that's kind of tied in there. It's not just any God that they're talking about, this in theist normativity. It's the Christian God that they're normalizing.
Yeah, well, and that's why I think it's important to have this different type of language, talk about theist normativity versus Christonormativity and recognizing they're not fully separated. So sometimes it's a vague God when we talk about theist normativity, and sometimes it's specifically the Christian God, depending on the context. And one of the ways that I kind of like to explain it is, like, within the kind of conception of the United States, there's kind of this ideal citizen. In terms of religion, that ideal citizen is white Protestant. And the further away you get from that, the more deviant and un-American you are. So like a conservative Jew might be closer to that ideal than a secular Jew. And an atheist is, particularly an atheist of color, is going to be one of the furthest away you can get from that ideal citizen. And it kind of ebbs and flows in like the purposes of what people are trying to do with this type of language as well.
Yeah. One other thing I kind of related to that, this idea of like a Judeo-Christian heritage or whatever, apparently that also came out in the Cold War and sort of like as a way to give the appearance of like being more than just about Christianity or something.
Yeah, absolutely. And you see this again when you look at a lot of the Christian nationalist narratives in the 1800s. You have things like reverends saying that they're appalled at the notion that the pledge does not have the Christian God because it's an invitation for infidels, pagans, Muslims, and Jews to come to the United States. And they're appalled by that idea. And even when In God We Trust first got added to coins, there were some Christian nationalist groups who argued that it no more ties the United States to the Christian God than to a Muslim God. So people were very critical of it. But what you see happened in the 1940s is really in the late 1800s and early 1900s, you see a pretty good rise in popularity of secularism and secularist ideas. And this was something that Christian nationalists were very threatened by. And there were a lot of greater calls for religious equality and a lot of religious minorities were really starting to fight against the kind of Protestant Christian privilege that has existed in the United States since its beginning. And so you see these moves being made for Christian nationalists to make calls to be more inclusive of different, specifically theistic religions, specifically white Christian religion, white theistic religions. And so as certain groups, particularly Catholics and Jews, were willing to kind of adhere to a certain level of religion of Christian privilege, there would be at least more tolerance towards them than there had been in previous years, at least rhetorically.
Wow. So the core of the message has remained the same for almost the entire history of the U.S. then.
Yeah. What's really interesting, I think, when we talk about Christian nationalism, particularly today, there's this interesting nostalgia for Christian nationalists who they want to return to what they say the Christian founding. And it's so interesting if you look at Christian nationalist narratives, because Christian nationalist narratives start by them saying the founding fathers made a mistake. In fact, some of them called it the original sin, and that we need to correct that mistake by putting the Christian God in the Constitution. But at some point in the 20th century, Christian nationalists shifted their narratives to saying, we were always a Christian nation, we have to return to that. And so one of the things that I argue is that today there's just a nostalgia for the amount of privilege that Christians, Protestant Christians in particular, did have in the 1800s. Because I think it's important to remember that while we talk about this ideal of the separation of church and state, that is certainly not an ideal the United States has always lived up to. Throughout U.S. history, there has been very clear Christian, particularly Protestant Christian privilege. There were states where you could be banned from voting, holding public office, if you were non-Christian. Christians were able to had a lot of power in public schools, and for example. And that those were things that they started to lose over time. And that's what modern Christian nationalists want to go back to.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about that. Because one of the, definitely like this bit of nostalgia seems to be part of that, any sort of right-wing narrative, right? This need to go back to a more ideal time. I mean, it's the whole premise of MAGA. And when we're talking about norms or normativity, usually we're talking about those unwritten rules of society, right? The way things are done, or manners, or maybe even like appropriateness, right? Or our basic understanding of who we are and how we interact with each other. But there seems to have been a shift in there between how it goes from being a norm to becoming institutionalized and either part of statecraft or even enforced through law. So how does some of these things, like the motto, be like putting "In God We Trust" on our money, how does that become law? And what are some of the other like anti-atheist or Christian nationalist laws that have been pushed through this form of theist normativity?
Yeah, so I think the 1950s are a particularly great time to look at this. I think you tend to see these types of laws come into play in times of national crisis. There's often times when there is conflict in society, there is an increase in religiosity for various reasons. So we see that in the Civil War. I think the 1950s are a really important example. There's a scholar named Jonathan Herzog who refers to this movement in the 1950s as kind of a spiritual industrial complex, where there was this very intentional attempt to try to make people religious. You have groups like the American Legion, who had their Back to God program, which was a national campaign to get people to go back to God. And there was a consistent narrative that in order to save ourselves from the atheistic communists, we have to reclaim our theistic identities. We need to remind people that they are a God-loving people. And so you see this narrative repeated again and again in the 1950s. And Under God is a really great example of that in the pledge, because in 1954, there was a preacher named George Dougherty who did a sermon suggesting we should add Under God to the pledge, because he claimed that without the phrase God, the pledge was so generic that it wasn't distinct from a pledge that could be said in the Soviet Union. And what made the United States distinct from communist countries is a belief in God. And they went so far as to say, he even said, like, this is not privileging Christianity because it's not talking about the Christian God. If we were to say one nation under Jesus Christ, that would be problematic. But because it's God, it's okay. But then he goes on to say, but what about the honest atheist who's just, trying to be sincere in their beliefs? Well, an atheist American is a contradiction of terms. And if someone rejects the Christian ethic, they're rejecting American ideals. Which is very confusing, because he had just said that it's absolutely Christian, but then he says if you reject the Christian ethic and if you're an atheist specifically, you're un-American.
Saying the quiet part out loud.
Yeah, and you see this pretty consistently of people talking about the phrase "under God" and reusing this phrase that an atheist American is a contradiction of terms, so it doesn't matter that they can't say the new pledge, because again, they're not really citizens. Or this notion of, we do need to promote Christianity, but then you simultaneously see people saying, this isn't about Christianity, it's about affirming our belief in God broadly. And so that's what's really hard to talk about in terms of, it's both theist normative and subtly Christo-normative if you really dig into the transcripts of these legislative procedures by members of Congress. And I think one story that I think makes it really clear just how pervasive this was that Under God was added in 1954, And by 1957, atheists were already trying to challenge it in courts. And there was a free thought group in New York that challenged it, and the judge ruled against them. And one of his arguments was that if we removed under God from the pledge at this point, it would be favoring atheists. So this notion that, you know, if we say under God, it's neutral, but if we remove under God and don't even say like no God, we just keep it completely agnostic, really, that's favoring atheists. And that's really how I think theist normativity oftentimes works, is that having God references is so normal, we're just so used to it, it's neutral and it's fair. But as soon as you say, hey, let's not do this, well, now we're attacking religion.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, like the way it can become like embedded in, you know, like once it's sort of established, then people sort of think, you know, it was always this way and like, you know, we can't change it now. But I mean, I think, you know, obviously it's relatively recent.
People very oftentimes don't realize that. And for me, I find it's a really great conversation starter with someone who is religious to kind of say, oh yeah, like, did you know this was added during the Red Scare as a kind of Red Scare tactic? And people are much more open to those conversations about why it might be problematic when they get that context.
It also sounds like it's like, we can see it in the sense that it's not an official proclamation in the sense that it's not writing a law saying like, you know, we put under God in the money or put under God in the Pledge of Allegiance. But it seems that it bled into, it did exactly what it intended to do, right? Got into people's heads, naturalized this, right? You're an American. Of course you believe in God. We're one nation under God. And then that's implemented by people who are either interpreting or enforcing the law. So things like a judge ruling... They weren't under orders to rule that way. They just ruled it because we had a phrase and it sounded like it spoke for everyone, right? That's what's happening.
Yeah, to a large extent, yeah. You start seeing a lot of different groups who have kind of ties to these kind of Christian nationalist beliefs using the phrase under God or in God we trust before it becomes kind of legislated by members of Congress into bills that kind of do give it some level of kind of, it becomes codified into the United States as here's proof that you're a Christian nation or a theistic nation, because members of Congress have said so. So that kind of becomes then proof in some ways. But then it is particularly interesting in the way that then judges will say something like, well, we've always had religious heritage, and under God or in God we trust are examples of kind of ceremonial deism, where it's not making any declaration about what people believe. It's just about ritual and respecting our religious heritage. But if we actually look at who was behind getting these passed and the arguments they were using, it was not just about supporting religious heritage. It was about trying to remind the American people of how they should see themselves. And atheists were not meant to be included in that.
Yeah. I think another way maybe this appears is sort of in politicians' speeches talking, you know, I think it's almost obligatory, like, to end every speech, like, God bless the USA or whatever. Well, do you think the frequency of that has increased? I mean, is that sort of a constant, do you think?
Yeah, no, it's definitely increased quite a bit from the 1950s. You see a huge shift. There's a couple of scholars, Domke and Co., who wrote a book called The God Strategy, and they did quantitative data where they actually recorded how much. And actually, they did this before Trump was president, but Obama had used God references more than any other president had. So it's something you see across the political spectrum. And it is something that, to a large extent, you do get to the point where if you don't refer to God, your citizenship is questioned. And you do see examples of this happen of politicians who get accused of being atheists just because they don't invoke God.
Yeah. I feel like, you know, maybe with Obama or other Democrats, there is almost this tendency maybe to like overcorrect, to like, you know, to avoid, I mean, obviously, maybe it doesn't make a difference. I mean, you know, Obama's citizenship was already questioned quite a bit. I guess that maybe there is this tendency to like really kind of overemphasize, if you're a Democrat, like to really emphasize the God language to sort of stave off potential criticism from Republicans. But I don't know really if it's actually effective. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that is part of it for sure, because there has been a tendency to accuse Democrats of being atheists in order to critique them, even though if you look at, statistically speaking, Democrats are, the majority of them do tend to be theistic, usually Christian. They're more likely to be religiously diverse than Republicans, for sure. And they're more likely to promote secularism. But oftentimes that promoted secularism is reframed as anti-God, which is a kind of, in this sense, being framed as being anti-American. And so they do have to really work to make sure they're not accused of that.
So it reinforces the norm, right? Even those who are seen as not part of it have to claim to be part of it.
Yeah, there's a lot of pressure to pass as theistic. And you see, even in there, especially at the national level, there are a handful of politicians who have said that they don't fall into traditional religious identities, but they tend to use other language, whether it's humanist, spiritual, not religious. And there was several years ago, there was a group, and I can't remember for sure if it was the American Humanist Association or another group, but they had said that about 25 people in Congress had told them that they didn't believe in God, but said they would deny it if they tried to out them. So this notion that being an open, it's, you know, I think part of theist normativity is not that being an atheist is a problem, it's being an open atheist that is the problem. And so there's a lot of pressure to pass as theistic, because if you don't, you're disrupting the norm. So even someone just saying, I'm an atheist, is almost viewed as like shoving your belief in someone's face. It's viewed as in ways that particularly for Protestant Christians is not considered problematic.
Yeah, I remember when Bonnie Frank, who's a congressman from Massachusetts, he became famous in the, God, I think it was 70s or 80s, because he came out as a homosexual. And at the time it was trailblazing, and it was, you know, it's astounding to have a gay member of Congress. But he didn't come out as an atheist until 2013.
Oh, right.
Which is like, that's super crazy, where you could, it was okay for him, or he was able to come out as gay with no repercussions, or, you know, not to lose his job, but he was still afraid to come out as an atheist.
Yeah. And there's a Gallup poll that is released every year, every couple of years, to ask people, like, what characteristics would make you vote or not vote for them for president? And pretty consistently, atheism is the lowest on that list, below any other religion. And it's much higher. In the 1950s, when this first happened, it was like 18%. Yeah. Now it's at like 6%, which is much higher, but it's still quite a bit below other.
It's above 50%. That's, I'll take it.
Yeah, we're doing it.
Yeah. But so this can be used a lot to sort of smear people and say, like, you're not, or, you know, you're not a true American. But has it ever been used to actually, I don't know, revoke someone's citizenship or deny them citizenship just based on a motto or a pledge? That hasn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It has happened. Yes. So it has. Actually, in the 1950s, there was a man named Walter Pliwoski, who was Jewish. And he was imprisoned during World War II. He escaped, and he actually joined the Allied forces and fought in World War II. Around that, he did become an atheist at some point during this time. And when he ended up joining the U.S. military, and he wanted to become a citizen. And when he did, he told the judge that he could not say the oath, so help me God. And he expected to be able to just say the affirmation, which is what other atheists tend to be allowed to do when they are not saying an oath. But the judge actually denied him citizenship. And specifically, he told him to take a coin out of his pocket and read what it says.
Oh.
And he used In God We Trust to justify denying him citizenship. And he appealed, and he did win his appeal fairly quickly. The judge's opinion was not overly popular. And I think a lot of the judges were like, this is not worth fighting, because atheist citizens are allowed to use an affirmation. And so to say that a non-citizen isn't allowed to, but really what the judge said is, if you're joining a society that is based its principles off of religious principles, you cannot deny those principles when you become a citizen. So, and it really wasn't until in the 1960s and 1970s that people were able to, it wasn't until 1961 that it became unconstitutional to deny someone the opportunity to become a public official based off their atheism. So that's relatively recent. And there have been numerous examples of atheists being denied the right to hold public office prior to that. And so it's definitely a very long history of the marginalization based off of these laws that we don't talk about very much. And I think that's a major part of the issue is we don't know the history of religious intolerance in the United States. So we almost have this myth of religious tolerance. And there's actually a great book by a scholar named David Sahet called The Myth of American Religious Freedom, where he talks about how there's a long history of the marginalization of atheists and different religious groups. And we need to talk about that more to understand our
history. Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point, because there's almost like there's two myths kind of existing simultaneously. Like there's a myth of like a Christian past, but then there's also a myth that the U.S. was always secular or something like that. I think it's sort of funny, like the way, and maybe they could even be held, you know, by the same person or something, like that. Yes, like our country was always Christian, but like no one was really discriminated against or whatever.
Yeah. And this is actually the David Sahet book. One of his key arguments is that there are these two narratives, the Christian nation, the secular nation, and they're both right and wrong. And we have to recognize the complexities and really point to there is a very long history of, again, various different groups being religiously persecuted in the United States. And we have to understand this history of religious tolerance if we're ever really going to live up to the ideal of religious freedom today and don't go back in time.
There's a lot to unpack there. That's tricky. Because it sounds like on the one hand, there is this sense of, okay, it's exclusionary, right? Where there's an in-group and an out-group. The in-group believes in God. But even once you get into that in-group, you know, it's like, yeah, those atheists, they're no good. Those non-theists, all right, we got rid of them. But then there's like, well, but the ones who really matter are the white Christians, right? And that's what they're promoting. Is that how it works? Is that the big picture?
Yeah, in a lot of ways. And I think it's interesting, especially contemporary Christian nationalists. And this is something that you definitely see evolve. At one point, a lot of Christian nationalists were completely fine with denying religious freedom to non-Christians. And a lot of Christian nationalists in the 1800s read religious freedom as the freedom of Christian denomination, not necessarily freedom of all religion. And that has evolved, where even contemporary Christian nationalists tend to agree with the idea that anyone has the right to be an atheist. Anyone has the right to be whatever religion they are. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they agree with the ideals of religious equality, and that all religions deserve the same access to the public sphere. And so if you have the right to practice your religion, but if that religion contradicts a conservative, typically a conservative Christian belief, well, then that's going to draw a line. So the equality is not necessarily there in the same way. So that's an important part of that conversation.
Man, that's messy. Who makes these rules? Like, is
that's... Well, and I'm going to make it even more complicated for you. We talk about Christian nationalism, and we're not just talking about Christians. People of any faith can agree with the ideals of Christian nationalism, including atheists. So one of the things that one of the assignments that I'll do in some of my classes is I'll talk about the addition of the phrase under God and the pledge. And then I will ask students at the end to write an essay in which they argue whether the phrase under God should remain in the pledge or not and explain their reasoning. And I tell them, you know, it doesn't matter if you're saying yes or no. Like, I'm not basing it off of your conclusion. I'm basing it off of, like, how do you support your argument? And every time I do that assignment, I have at least one student who says, I am an atheist, but I think it should stay because people need a belief in God to keep them moral, and this helps them do that. And that, I think, goes back to that normativity, in that oftentimes normative narratives, even people who are most hurt by them, will accept them. And because they're oftentimes framed as common sense, so this idea of being a good citizen and being a moral citizen is tied to belief in God. So even someone who doesn't believe in God has heard that so often, they've internalized that.
Yeah. Wow. And then you fail those students, correct?
No, absolutely not. Because as long as you know, that's, again, it's not my job to change that. But it is just, I find it so fascinating because I didn't expect that. But it, you know, I always say, like, students teach me things. And I think that's a great example of me thinking about how Christian nationalism is so ingrained that even people who are most hurt by it. And on the flip side, I have plenty of students who are Christian or of different religions who say, no, this is absolutely not okay. And we should remove it because it violates the basic values of democracy and religious freedom. So it's, you know, anybody, no matter their religious beliefs, can support or reject Christian nationalist ideals.
I feel like they're sort of like, I mean, I guess like an atheist could say like, well, you know, I'm a very moral person, but those other people over there, they need a like a higher power to be moral, but not me, because I'm somewhat, you know, maybe I'm special or something in some way.
Well, and this is, again, it's really interesting, is even studies that ask people to judge morality, even atheists are more inclined to agree with the idea that atheists are less moral, even though there's not evidence to support that. But I think that points to how pervasive and in many ways problematic these narratives are, is that they become ingrained, that even people who, you know, it hurts the most, they accept these narratives as truth, even though if there's no evidence to support them.
That's a very interesting perspective, because one of the things that actually may have inspired Nathan and I to start the podcast was polling about what young atheists feel is important. And as like Nathan and I are geriatric, we're not the young atheists anymore. We're the gravers. The lowest priority was public displays of, or like religious displays in public. So things like Ten Commandments, In God We Trust, and the money. That was lowest priority among atheists. But like, we thought that's weird, and they just thought like, okay, but they have things that are more important, right? Like everything they cared about was education, healthcare, climate change, LGBTQ rights. That's more important. You know, these other things are further down the line. But I had never considered one possibility is that they've just internalized it. It's worked incredibly well. They've internalized it, and now they're reproducing that norm, even against their will, against their interest.
Yeah. Well, and I think there's kind of two things to that. I think one is like we almost don't notice it. I know even for me, I actually back like 7 or 8 years ago, I gone to the Reason Rally. And while I was staying at a hostel, and there I met a guy from New Zealand who was not going to the Reason Rally, but we were just talking about why I was there. And he was like, you all have so much religion in the public sphere. And I was like, no, we don't. And he's like, yes, you have crosses and references to God everywhere. And it wasn't until someone from outside the United States pointed that out to me that I was like, oh my gosh, you're right. And I'm like, is that weird? He's like, yeah, it's really weird. We don't have that in New Zealand. I was like, oh, okay. So I do think that, yeah, you almost don't notice it because it's so normal. But then on the other hand, one of the things I know exactly the survey you're talking about, because I use it all the time when in research talks, is that I think it makes sense to say things like, you know, LGBTQ rights or healthcare or secular schools are more important than like, you know, just removing a Ten Commandments statue. That's not obviously not making any immediate harm on somebody. But one of the things that I argue is that they're closely tied together. So I'm not saying that removing these monuments is more important, but by having monuments like In God We Trust on public property, by having In God We Trust, it reinforces the normativity that leads to these other things that harm the other issues. And one of the reasons we know that is groups like Project Blitz, which is a kind of initiative by a Christian nationalist group. They have what they kind of call phases and bills they're
Project
trying to pass.
Blitz.
And phase one bills. Yeah, Project Blitz is the name of this group. It's very complicated because it's the Congressional Prayer Caucus is kind of the group behind it. And this Project Blitz was the initiative. Now, they've changed the name multiple times, and they've talked about how, because they're trying to kind of stay underground. So at one point, they changed their name to Freedom for All. I think they changed the name again, but I can't figure out what the name is right now. So it's very, it's almost like, it's kind of a, in some ways, a legislative coup in which they're trying to basically blitz the country with as much Christian nationalist legislation as possible and hoping some of it sticks. And they're very secretive about how they do it. But their phase one bills are things like In God We Trust bills. So things getting In God We Trust on public schools, on license plates, on police cars, on public buildings, those types of things. And they have this playbook that they share among their members, and usually some journalist finds it and shares it every year, which is very convenient. But they talk about these being phase one bills and being these phase one bills being important for getting them to phase two bills, which are things like Christian Heritage Weeks, Bible literacy classes in schools, which helps them get to phase three bills, which are things like declaring marriage between a man and a woman, things like that. And so one of the things that I argue is that even though, yes, these In God We Trust bills might not seem important because they're not having an immediate effect, they do help if they start this narrative of like, oh, we're a nation that believes in God. And then it's an easier jump to we're a Christian nation. And then it's an easier jump to we need to base our laws on conservative Christian beliefs. And that's what Christian nationalists are trying to do with these types of mottos. So I would argue they are still very important to help us fight these other issues that we care about that have more immediate, obvious effects on people.
Yeah. And I feel like in some way there's some kind of like, there's an asymmetry in some way, like where atheists and secular people are kind of expected to just sort of like go along with this sort of stuff. Like, you know, if we make too big a fuss of it, you know, like it comes across as very aggressive or something like that, you know, to just to question it.
So yeah, I think one of the things that's important to keep in mind is that when groups challenge things like In God We Trust bills, Christian nationalists very quickly turn that around to, oh, this is our national motto. Why do you hate America? Or, oh, why are you against God? Why do you hate religion? This is more proof of the persecution of Christianity or of religion broadly. And so it kind of then reinforces this like anti-religious atheist narrative. Even if it has nothing to do with being anti-religious, it's about challenging Christian nationalism. Those nuances don't matter within a Christian nationalist narrative. And so it's frustrating because it's very hard to challenge these without getting accused of being anti-religious, even if you're religious and you're challenging them, you get then accused of actually being an atheist. So it's very difficult, which is what makes them so powerful.
So are there ways that have been successful to combat that? Or are some strategies better than others?
Yeah, I mean, I think you definitely have to keep the argument based in kind of a idea of this violates religious equality. And kind of those framings. But specifically the challenging the motto In God We Trust is incredibly difficult because it has been legally declared a national motto. So that becomes quite challenging. So I think on a grand scale, it's quite difficult. But I think this is where having one-on-one conversations is really important. And one of the ways to kind of challenge theist normativity is to bring people's attention to it. So, for example, even my family are all still religious. We're very respectful of each other's differences in religion, but they're now very familiar with these histories because I study them a lot. And so now when my mom sees someone say, our founding fathers believe in one nation under God, she'll hop on social media and be like, actually, that's not true. Under God was added to the Pledge of Allegiance in 1954. And because she's a Christian, she carries a little bit more weight in her ability to have those conversations. So this is one of the reasons why I'm actually a really big advocate of interfaith coalitions, interfaith dialogue, because I think it's impossible to really challenge this theist normativity and the theist normative legislation like In God We Trust just as atheists, because you're going to very quickly get accused of being an anti-theist. You need to build coalitions with religious groups, including Christian groups that support secularism, and have them do a lot of that public arguments as well.
Yeah. And I think that there's also like sort of coming at it like sort of at a side angle, almost not to sort of challenge these things directly, but just to say like, here's the way these kinds of arguments work. Here's what the Christians or whoever are trying to do when they put forward arguments about the country always being a Christian nation or something like. And I think like, yeah, like getting people maybe aware of like the way, like the way that these sort of rhetorical moves work, And then, like you said, like then you start seeing it and say like, aha, like here's an example of this. And in that way, it's, you're not even challenging it directly. It's like, you're challenging it from like an order above or below. I'm not sure which way, but.
Absolutely. And I think framing it in this sense of like, we're having a conversation about what does religious equality and religious tolerance mean? And do things like a motto in God We Trust, which was, you know, became our national motto during the Red Scare. How is that supporting or undermining that value of religious equality and religious freedom? And asking that question is one that I have found people find really interesting, because oftentimes they never thought about it before in that sense.
I haven't. Well, maybe I have. Maybe I do want to undermine it. I'm so confused now.
Sorry.
This has been a lot. I think I'm a little overwhelmed right now.
Yeah, that's kind of my daily basis. And like, I think it's hard for me too, because like I said, I study this theist normativity, which is the marginalization of atheists. And that's where I started. But then inevitably that led me to Christian nationalism. And one of the things I realized is you can't really understand the marginalization of atheists until you understand the way that Christian nationalism is ingrained in U.S. culture. And so like, we could have an entire podcast just about the marginalization of atheists. We can have an entire podcast just on Christian nationalism. And we're kind of trying to do both here. And it is very overwhelming and difficult. And I'm still parsing out all the nuances of it all.
Yeah. But it is sort of like two sides of the same coin, which has In God We Trust on it, I guess.
Yes, very much so. In God We Trust is, I would argue, not the most ideal motto, because it does both. It both dismisses atheists on very obvious ways, and then it reinforces Christian nationalism in more subtle ways.
And ironically, the other side of the coin says E Pluribus Unum, which is out of many, one. That conundrum, that contradiction is completely baked in. It's become a physical entity and it sits in our pockets and we never even noticed it. My goodness, that's the genius of your work, that bringing this to
Thank
life.
You.
Well, all right, let's make it a little easier and just have some straightforward questions with no wrong answers. And we'll ask you about what a true atheist can and cannot do. This is called Can a True Atheist.
All right.
Simple. They're just yes, no questions that you can elaborate on your answer. There's no wrong answer. Okay. Are you ready?
Okay.
So we'll make it easy. First one, can a true atheist believe in God?
So I am going to say yes, in the sense that I think, which that sounds weird. Partially at this, I should say this, that I do think anytime you say like, can someone be truly something, and then you exclude people, like can cause problems. And so I'm going to probably say yes to most things. But I think that, you know, for me at least, like when I was becoming an atheist, it was a 7-year process. And there were days I believed in God and there was days that I didn't. And so I think saying like, oh, you can never like doubt your disbelief. And if you doubt your disbelief, you're not a true atheist. Like, I think that's problematic in some ways. So I think that you can still be an atheist and have some days where you're like, well, maybe God does exist. What you were learned as young, and be like, maybe in this moment I do, and then maybe go back to it. So, you know, I think that belief can be fluid.
Was that the last thing to go? Like the belief in God?
Yeah.
Wow. So like you stopped going to church, you stopped praying, but the last thing was the belief in God.
Yeah. It was very much like, it started with, I stopped believing the Bible was the word of God. I stopped believing organized religion. Then I stopped believing that Jesus was the Son of God. I was probably, I knew I didn't believe in God for about a year before I willingly said out loud that part. So I think like, yeah, like that whole time there were days when maybe I did like, well, maybe I do believe in God. And so it was just, I think it's complicated in that sense.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. So there's some kind of like blurry boundary between when you're Christian, when you're atheist. Yeah. That was a bold answer.
Saying yes. I know.
Most people say no. Okay. How about this? Can a true atheist consider something sacred?
Yeah, I think, you know, depending on how we define sacred, I think there's a tendency to associate terms like sacred with the religious, but like you can have something be secular and sacred. Like I hold some of my, like, I consider my family relationship sacred to me. So I think I don't particularly like it when groups say, like, oh, sacred is a religious only thing. Like, who gets to decide that? Like, we can redefine sacred if we want to.
Yeah.
And so.
Okay. Well, with that in mind, can a true atheist commit a sin?
I guess it's who's judging. If an atheist doesn't believe in sin, then they're not. If someone else thinks it's a sin and they interpret it, fine. But I would say from an atheist perspective, probably not. But
old choice again.
Again, I'm so into these nuances, and I don't like making things into strict categories that simple yes no answers don't sit well with me.
We should maybe like force people to take a stance one way or the other. all right. Can a true atheist cross out the "In God We Trust" on money?
I mean, technically, I think it might be illegal to deface money, but like, you're probably not going to get persecuted for it. So it can be a great way to disrupt theist normativity. So while I'm not going to like tell people to do it, I'm probably not going to like turn you in if you do. And I'm secretly going to maybe applaud you.
Okay. Good to know. Can a true atheist say thank you when someone says, "I'm praying for you"?
I mean, you can. But yeah, I think it's that matter of like, do you really want to deal with challenging the theist normativity in that moment, or do you just want to not deal with the details? I find that there's a particular violence, I think, to someone knowing that you're an atheist and saying, "I'll pray for you," that is emotionally hard to deal with. So I think that atheist has to decide what they're emotionally willing to deal with in that moment. And sometimes thank you is just emotionally easier than having the argument.
Yeah,
I sense that you've had this happen to you before.
Oh, so many times, all the time.
Right. Yeah.
I actually do at some point want to write like a paper about the kind of the violence of that particular phrase in the experience of atheists, because it is used in like this. It's this phrase that's framed in this really nice way, but it's really not nice. When someone knows you're an atheist and they go out of their way to say, "I'm praying for you," where it's not actually that sincere.
Yeah, definitely. I think it definitely, the situation depends. You know, if the person knows you're an atheist, it's definitely very rude, I think, on their part.
Yeah.
I guess if they don't know,
then they're just engaging in theist normativity. They're just engaging in theist normativity and like,
yeah,
you have to decide whether you're going to challenge that theist normativity or not.
Yeah.
It's really fun to say, "Oh, I'm actually an atheist, but thanks for the gesture." I don't know.
yeah. Okay. Can a true atheist wear crucifix jewelry?
I'm weirdly going to say yes again. Very specifically, like, I actually have a cross necklace that belonged to my grandma. And so like wearing it for, and I don't wear it very often because I don't want people to think that I'm a Christian, but if I wore it, it would be because I'm remembering her, not because I actually believe. So I think there's reasons why someone might. It's not very common, but it might lead to interesting conversations.
That's true. Speaking of interesting conversations, can a true atheist place a satanic statue on public property?
Yes.
Absolutely. That's the most unequivocal answer you've given.
That's the easy one. Yes.
I know. I just think in the sense that, like, I mean, a true atheist, I mean, if you're doing the, I mean, what the Satanic Temple is doing, you know, most of them are atheists, and, you know, they've done this really interesting thing where they've created an atheistic religion where they worship Satan, not literally, but as a symbol. And then they use it to try to disrupt Christian privilege. Like, I think it's a brilliant idea. Like, I think it's a really interesting way to force people to think about what does religious equality really mean. So I would say, like, yeah, you can definitely do that. And I think it's a great way to disrupt Christian nationalism.
Yeah, definitely. Yes. Can a true atheist say, "God damn it," when you step your toe?
I'm going to say again, yes, in that situation. And I think, again, it that shows the way that theist normativity is ingrained in our societies. We just, I mean, I will use God references all the time, or even saying like, say bless you when someone sneezes. And I'm like, oh, there's so much religion tied to that, but it's so ingrained in our culture and the way we say things. Plus it's kind of blasphemous anyway. So it's not like people really like it when you say it.
And finally, can a true atheist think that religion on the whole is a force for good in the world?
Yeah, I think an atheist can believe that. I mean, I think it's like anything, like religion has good components of it. There's bad components to it. And I think anybody can make their own conclusion as to if there has more good or more problematic aspects. And that's a fun debate to have with people.
Well, this has been fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely fascinating. The hour flew by.
Yeah. Nathan, I completely forgot how we wrap these up.
I guess, Christina, we can ask if there's any anything you want to plug, articles or whatever.
I mean, I have a couple of articles on the website called The Conversation that I've published. I have an article coming out this fall, actually, in Rhetoric Society Quarterly that specifically looks at the history of how Christian nationalists got "In God We Trust" on coins and as the national motto, and how modern Christian nationalists have then utilized it to push their agenda. So that's an article that's coming out that really digs into this history a lot more in detail than what we've talked about today.
Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah, those will be linked below. Professor Christina Lee, thank you so much. This has been fantastic.
Thank you.
Okay, that was Dr. Christina Lee. That was a really fascinating conversation. Todd, what were your thoughts about it?
Well, I made the point several times. It just kept blowing my mind. There were three or four things in there that I think were really, really rich. But for us, I think like one of the things that we're seeing, this has come up in the past few episodes, is what the opposition is doing, which is something we don't really focus on.
Right.
In this case, it's really important to sort of to get a handle on it so we can move past it and project our own power, right? And make the world a more secular world that we're comfortable in, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, was there anything particular that stood out to you, like that we're up against or?
Yeah, I think on that note, one thing that was interesting to me was, I think we mentioned, you know, how polls of atheists or younger atheists, I guess, didn't necessarily place a priority on fighting against these more symbolic issues like "In God We Trust" and Ten Commandments monuments. But I think Christina did a really good job explaining how these are connected, how they're connected to other fights more broadly against the Christian nationalist agenda that this Project Blitz, I think it goes, maybe she said it goes by a different name now, but this idea of like, you know, introducing these more symbolic measures as sort of initial kind of wedges, like to get their foot in the door sort of. And then there's another, then once that's done, there's more kind of substantial laws or whatever that are introduced, which more directly impact people's civil rights. And I think that's a really important point that she made, that it's all connected. And I don't think, you know, we shouldn't necessarily like just sort of give ground on those issues, because it is connected.
No, and you're right. We can't just give ground. She pointed out here, and I think she goes into some of the articles we have linked below. One of them is specifically about this. And in it, she talks about how it's part of the design of Project Blitz is to overwhelm opposition.
Right? Yes,
if you're doing this everywhere, one organization just can't stop it, right? You're just not going to have the manpower to stop it everywhere. It's 1,000 brush fires. It's almost just a harassment attack. And you just wear people down until they give in, and then you move on to phase two and phase three.
Yeah, right.
And so this I think is key for us when we're thinking about beyond atheism, right? Like, yeah, we've identified a major part of the problem. It's
it's what we've always suspected. These things are Trojan horse attacks. They're not just symbolic. They're not welcome for everybody. It's part of a concerted effort to impose religion on people. But it also means like the way that we combat it can't be this reactionary struggle to, you know, just push down, like try to put out every little, you know, put a pin in every city in the U.S. and say, well, we have to stop them here. And then we have to stop them here. And then we stop them here. Thing is like we have to generate our own form of atheist normativity, right? What are the ways that we can promote atheism generally, broadly, openly, and chip away, like wear down at theist normativity that says everyone believes in God. Everyone should believe in God. Because one of the things that we've seen is like that the good professor talked about was how, you know, the results that she gets are that this is after she explains it to people how it works, that people are atheists and they still support theist normative structures and institutions, keeping the motto on the money, keeping under God in the Pledge of Allegiance. Like that's, it has an effect. And we talked about this also with the things like the sign pirates, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's particularly difficult because our platform is at its heart, no religion. And you can't put that on a billboard.
Right. Yes.
You can
yes.
put up a cross. You can put up a crescent moon. You can put up a Star of David, whatever it is, right? Like you can put up the symbol and boom, right? You have the symbol of religion. You can't just put up a symbol of no religion, right? It's like telling someone, don't think of an elephant. Don't think of an elephant, Nathan.
Yes.
Don't think of an elephant. If you're listening at home, don't think yes. of an elephant, but we know what animal you're thinking of. So we have to think of other ways to combat it. And I mean, like, one, I would say a podcast.
That's way. That's the first step. Yes.
So people, that one's taken. What are some other things we can do?
Yeah. I think like she's been doing to just even to begin to get people to realize like what's you know, the fact that there is this kind of theist normativity. It's just sort of, because it is so kind of entrenched in various institutions and mottos and on the money and so on, it's just, you may not even really realize it until someone points it out to you. And I think just the way, yeah, pointing out that rhetorical strategy or political strategy will help people identify it and then, yeah, hopefully counter it or question it or whatever. I think it's just one other sort of tangential point, I guess, is that it's interesting because like it has political effects like we've talked about, but there's also personal effects too. And I mean, I don't feel particularly or really in any way discriminated against or something as an atheist, but I mean, but that's me in kind of secular candidate, like in a sort of secular Canada and, you know, in a kind of reasonably large city and so on. But I mean, I think definitely for people in more religiously conservative areas, there's real harm to it, like on a personal level. So I think that's also important too. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, the thing is you can't undo it in one go, right? It's a long process. And what's that process going to be? I will say in, defense of the secular Northeast.
Mm-hmm.
I do remember as a child once counting all of the churches mm-hmm. in my hometown mm-hmm. and comparing that to the number of pizza places.
Right.
And we had more pizza places.
Okay. Nice.
So I took that as a very positive sign. That's good. Never live in a place where there's more churches than pizza places.
Or even better, you might get like a church that has been closed down and is now been transformed into a pizza place.
Oh my God. Can you imagine? That would be the best, right? That's who's really winning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's not funny isn't the right word, but like it's paradoxical, I guess, like how Christian nationalism is really surging, it seems, in the past several years. Whereas at the same time, you know, churches seem to be hemorrhaging members and so on. But yeah. I don't, maybe it's not a paradox because it's like, because it's a sign of weakness almost that they're even more kind of wanting to like, we need to, you know, have it on the police cards or something that in God we trust because we know that we're losing. So it could be like a sign of like a last desperate cry or whatever. Hopefully, yeah.
I agree, but they're also willing to use violence, as we've recently seen, yeah, to maintain, yes, power.
Yeah, right.
And yeah, you're right. There's, when we think about atheists, we think about ourselves, we think about the demographic forces, what's coming. There's more of us. We're right, and we're winning. We've been winning. We're going to continue to win as long as we continue to push back. And one of the things is we have to find a way to combat this aspect, right? This, the norms of it, right? We have to show, and it, like, it lays out pretty clearly what you have to do. Like, citizenship is not connected to religion, right? What is it about atheists that makes them better patriots, or as good patriots, or at least patriotic, or at least good citizens? What is it about atheists that makes them moral, ethical, right? How do we highlight that? How do we show it's not tied to our identity? And this is something that, like, a national identity, our local identity, our civic identity, just something lots of atheist groups have to do for any particular community. This one's just on a bigger scale.
Yeah. I think also, you know, we've talked to many different organizers who are involved in various sorts of charity things around their local community. And when they do it, I think, like, when we were talking to Mandisa Thomas, maybe, you know, like, wearing, like, the Black Nonbelievers t-shirt or something like that. You know,
incredibly.
Yeah, definitely. Well, just, and then, like, you know, people see atheists or secular people involved in doing charity. And I mean, I think it's like, you know, they realize maybe atheists are not immoral, uncharitable, etc.
Yeah. And I mean, that's a great point. And I think we've also seen recently that they're, I think it's New York State is trying to make, court ordered, substance abuse counseling, make secular alternatives.
Right.
Like, yeah, authorize that where you can go to secular alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
Huge.
Yeah.
Huge part of it. Right. That's, you're moving into the institution building.
Yeah. Yeah. That's another good, point on the theist normativity angle too, or like a challenge to it. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, this is a lot of cultural thinking. It's a lot of interpersonal thinking. It's how do we develop these beliefs and behaviors and assumptions about people, right? We've heard all of this, but now it's time to think about it. It should inform how we act, not just how we react. So, I mean, of course, let's put it out there. If you've been doing this, if you found something that's been working, if you find a way to interact with people, if you have an answer for when someone tells you that they're going to pray for you, we'd love to hear that. Hit us up at Nath G. Alexander. Is it Nath G. Alexander?
Nath,
there are no dots in the Twitter, are there?
No dots. Nath G. Alexander.
Nath G. Alexander.
On Twitter, yeah. Yes. Yep.
Always love hearing from the fans.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And of course, big thank you to Dr. Lee. Big thank you to the audience. Thank you guys for listening. And especially to our patrons.
Mm-hmm. Lars, Debbie, and the AHS Plus blog.
Yes.
Thanks.
Big ups. Yes. Love you guys. Thank you so much. Yep. And of course, we did it again this week, kind of by accident. All the best stuff is behind the paywall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah, you've got to check that out. Included, well, my favorite story is about, like, why the Pledge of Allegiance was only forced upon people for 3 years. That's a pretty harrowing tale about how crazy things can get, but also kind of hopeful, I guess. You'll have to check it out. So thanks to the audience. If you can't throw us a couple bucks, press the like and subscribe, smash those buttons, and otherwise, we'll talk to you later.